Hey, everybody. Welcome to our monthly leadership podcast. If you are a regular podcast subscriber, you know that Lane Jones is normally our host. But today, I'm filling in for Lane because one of my favorite people in the world is filling in for me. Now, if you were to ask me, as sometimes I'm asked, who outside of your family, Andy, or who outside of your parents were the most influential people in your life, the first person on my list is our guest today, Charlie Renfro. Charlie has been a mentor. We'll talk about that. He's been a friend. He's been a board member. And for those of you who've read any of my books or listened to any of my messages, I have quoted Charlie more than anybody else. In fact, Charlie, I've quoted you so many times, I started changing your name so people thought I had more than one friend or more than one influence in my life. Charlie and Patty have five children, three sons that work in the family business, one son that's in heaven. His daughter, Krista, also works in family business, 11 grandchildren. And Charlie and I met 30 years ago. Met 30 years ago in about 1985 when I was starting my first real job. Charlie, you were about, I think we figured up, you were 43 or 44 years old. And right. As you said, you were fighting alligators and bank officers. We're going to talk about that. Charlie participated in our church when I was working for my father. And his kids were in our youth group, and I was a youth pastor. And so one day, this 40-something-year-old guy walks up to me and says, "Hey, Andy, let's have breakfast." We had breakfast. That became a regular thing, and it literally, as you're going to discover, impacted my life in a significant, significant way. And the story that most of you who have listened to me for some time have heard me tell about Charlie, and this will put it all in context, Charlie would walk into the original House of Pancakes. I'd be there waiting for him about 6:30 in the morning. He'd be all dressed up in his suit and his tie and his cufflinks, and he'd sit down and smack his ring down on the table and say, "Andy, what you working on big? What you working on big?" And at that point in my life, I wasn't working on anything big. Big was just trying to get to work and keep my job. But Charlie believed that I had the potential to work on stuff big and saw that maybe one day I would be. So would you please give a Andy Stanley Leadership Podcast welcome to my friend, Charlie Renfro. Thrilled that you're here, Charlie.
Andy, thank you so much for inviting me, and I'm just excited to be here with you about this conversation.
Yeah, well, it's about to get really exciting. So here's what I want to do. We're going to get things way out of order, and I want to start with where you were in your career when we first met. You were about 44 years old.
Yes.
I was this leading a youth group of 100 people or 100 kids or so, trying to get them home from Six Flags on time. I wasn't working on anything big, as I said. You, on the other hand, had several businesses you were involved in, and you had just gotten into something really, really big. So just kind of catch us up with a little bit about what was going on right then.
Yes. We had just moved to Atlanta in 1985, and we, as you said, we were in business in Macon and Tuscaloosa and East Tennessee, in the billboard business and the mini warehouse business down in Macon and Tuscaloosa. And in those two businesses of the mini warehouse, we had gotten off into another business called document storage, records archive storage of
files. Yeah, files boxes,
yeah,
full of files.
Tax returns, law documents. Documentation, titles,
medical records,
medical records, blueprints, Coca-Cola, payroll slips, the whole thing. I mean, anything that was generated off of a computer and printed out, we kept as an off-site storage facility in those two markets. Well, when I moved to Atlanta, I had the opportunity to go down and visit a man that owned a company called Atlanta Archives, and they had all the law firms' records in Atlanta and all the accounting firms, all the big eights. They had the Southern Company's records, all of the documentations and paperwork that are involved in running an accounting firm, tax returns, law, wills, all those kind of things.
Tens of thousands of boxes.
300,000 boxes of records.
Wow.
In a building down next door to where the aquarium is today.
Hmm. And the reason this was big business in Atlanta is because office rents were so high, and these companies couldn't afford to store records on site because of what they were paying for their square footage with office space.
Yeah, that's correct. And in downtown Atlanta, in the Peachtree Centers and all these big multi-story buildings, the firms just rented what they needed as far as office space for their personnel was concerned, because at that time office rents were $20 and $25 a square foot. That was tremendously expensive to be storing inactive or active records in another room that you were paying that kind of rent for.
Right.
So early on, they were using off-site storage. when I stumbled on that business in Atlanta, I saw right away that there was an opportunity to take our marketing experience of advertising and promoting this business to another level, because the man that was operating it was a really wonderful man, but he was an accountant type of person, and we approached it from a marketing service oriented
type. So you ended up buying his business.
Yeah, I visited with him for about 3 or 4 weeks, and I think it was, you know, we called it a trauma center because there was so much going on that was uncontrollable, and he had all the records on 3x5 cards.
Oh, my.
There was no computerization that he was sophisticated enough to use, and then which we later brought in a, you know, an IBM AS400 and had our own programmer that did the work to keep up with all that. But when I suggested to him, I said, Ken, do you think you might be interested in buying this, selling me your business? He said, yeah, I'd love to talk about that. And the next morning, I brought him a contract. He signed it, and he left. And I found out about a week later why he left, because I had just bought an emergency room. And I didn't know how to be a medic.
Yeah. But as always, and for so many of our podcast listeners, this is where they live. You saw an opportunity.
Yes.
You didn't know anything about this business, but you saw the opportunity and decided to act, to initiate. So then what happened?
Well, we acquired that company from him, and then as I started looking around to say, okay, if we're going to be in the archives business in Atlanta, Georgia, the document storage, then I want to be the best, I want to be the biggest, and I want to be the best known. So we're going to market this. So then I started looking around, and there were 4 or 5 other small mom-and-pop archival storage companies, and so we started working with those people, and eventually we acquired all of them. We bought all of them, and so we became the largest record center, archival storage center, in a top 5 market in, you know, the United States that was family owned.
So you purchase a business you don't know much about, then you purchase all the smaller versions of that business that you are still learning about. As I heard you say one time, this was an unsolved opportunity.
Yes. Yes, it was.
And a very capital-intensive opportunity because, of, again, you've decided not to just do this but to market this. And that's what led to the next chapter in this story.
Yes, it was. And when we started acquiring all these other companies and then started doing a little marketing to it, when I bought the guy's business, all the vans were white. They didn't have their name on it. And I said, why don't you have your name on the side of the vans? They're all over town. They're all over Atlanta. He said, well, that's our security. We don't want people to know what we do. I said, well, nobody cares anything about dead records. I've never heard of anybody holding up a truck and stealing a box of records and, you know, on the side of the road. So we immediately developed a marketing campaign. We painted all the trucks, data management, business records. We developed brochures. At that time,
and let me interrupt, but you didn't just paint the sides of those vans. I was in your office one day, and you said, Andy, look down there, and I'm on, I don't know, we're on the 10th floor of wherever your office was, and I looked down, and there's a data management van, and the reason I knew it was a data management van is why?
The logo was on top of the van.
On top of the vans, that's right, because you said, all these people up here in these high-rises, they're looking down, I want them to see our data management van. So you put the logo on the top. That was so smart.
Right, we did. And at that time, my son Chuck had just graduated from Baylor University. And Chuck is a very erudite, articulate person and was very good at making great communication marketing pieces. So he had just graduated from Baylor, and I said, Chuck, I bought this trauma center, and I need for you to come out here and help me market it, and now's your one chance, so come on. And so he loaded up and moved to Atlanta. He was single at the time. And my second son, Scott, had started working with our company in our many warehouse divisions. So when I bought this big archive center in Atlanta, I moved Scott up to Atlanta, and he started working in the operations side, which was managing the trucks and the drivers and the shelving, and the capital intensive part of it, Andy, was keeping the trucks running, buying new trucks, shelving. We were taking in 25,000 and 30,000 boxes a month.
Wow.
New boxes. Well, you couldn't set them on the floor. So we had a shelving company that we had cut a deal with that they were bringing weekly racks of shelving and putting them up in these warehouses that we were renting. And that was the capital intensive part. So at this time in our outdoor advertising business, we had become involved with some financing people that were trying to get big national banks to finance billboard companies and the such. So we became introduced to this bank called National Westminster in New York that everybody was running trying to do, you know, finance billboard companies. And so they introduced us to this company. We had at that time, you know, a 15-year track record of incredible growth in the outdoor side. We had just got into this archival business that they understood a little bit about because they used it themselves in New York with this Iron Mountain company up there. So we developed this big line of credit on a non-recourse basis because they just took our whole company and they didn't require personal guarantees because it was a cash flow lending
right.
scenario.
People are renting box. They were paying you to hold on to their boxes.
Right. We were the big side of it was the storage side, but the really big side was the service side because we were retrieving and delivering and picking up and scanning and going back and forth and picking. You know, we had trucks running all over Atlanta, Georgia. That's when I got the idea to paint the logos on the top of the vans because you could look out of any office building and there's all these service vehicles down there, and ours was the only one that had our name on the top of them. And we also had that same logo on our boxes. So we had boxes sitting in every major office in Atlanta, Georgia, with data management on the side. When I bought the company, they were just brown boxes yep. with no name on them.
So you're running and gunning, making lots of money. Things are great. You have this big line of credit. I think you said like $13, $15 million mm-hmm. line of credit.
Yes.
Which, again, that's a lot of money. But back in the 80s, that was a whole lot of money.
That was a lot of money.
And it's a family-owned business
yep.
still. And then the economy goes flat, and that's when there was a little bit of tension with your new friends up in New York. So pick
right.
it up there.
Well, on cash flow lending, they like to have all kinds of projections and charts and graphs and stuff, most of it beyond even the comprehension of the people asking for it. You know, and I understood it because I knew what we were doing and what our cash flow was going to be if we continued to invest the capital in the shelving and the new billboards and the new mini warehouse buildings. I understood how that would affect our cash flow, and we had the plan on, you know, we knew what the accounts receivable was going to be. We had a great plan for managing the accounts receivables. So all these projections with this $12, $15 million line of credit was based on a forward moving upward moment of increased cash flow, increased volume, and
growth,
all of that.
Growth.
Well, when the economy flattened out in the early 90s, the covenants that we had based on the forward-moving projections flattened out. So we were not going to be able to make some of these financial covenants, not financial payments, but the covenants. And as they were ramping up, then in the next year or two, the principal payments were going to ramp up as mm-hmm. well. So in our cash flow projecting that we did monthly, we were projecting 6 months out exactly what our cash flow needs were going to be and what our capital needs were going to be so we could match them up.
And you saw a problem looming.
Yeah, we saw a problem coming.
Yep.
We saw a storm coming. And it was going to be a big storm if we did not, it was going to be a major hurricane if we did not have a game plan that would address that. So my good friend Tom Mayfield, who at that time I had made president of the data management division, as he was a banker friend, personal friend of mine from Galveston, Texas. He had been a bank president for 20 years. He understood all of the ramifications and inner workings of the banking financial deal, and he was a tremendous assistance to me, and I relied heavily on him. And that's another one of your things, Ann, you talk about leadership, is getting good people around you that know what they're doing, that are experts in their arena, and delegating to them. You do a lot of podcasts on delegation. Well, delegation is important because if you're not willing to do that, then you're relying on yourself to do everything, and I could not do everything. So Tom says, Charlie, here's what we got to do. Next June, we're not going to be able to make that increased principal payment. We can make the interest payments and the current principal payments, but unless this economy turns around, we're not going to make that. We're going to hit the wall, as we say. So he says, I suggest that we call New York, say we want to come up there next week. We want to bring you some financial information and tell you about a game plan we got for next June. And so that's what we called calling the 500-pound gorilla out of the cage.
Now, this is this became a word picture that you've talked about a lot, and anybody who's listened to me speak or listen to this podcast, I've talked about that. And this was a big moment for me, because as you were explaining to me, I was 27, 28 years old. As you're talking about all this high finance, I never understood half your stories, but I knew they must be true and they must be important. I'm thinking about a situation I had at work where basically I didn't have to go to New York. I just had to walk down the hall,
right,
and walk in a door and open a conversation that I was avoiding, because
right,
I'd become a conflict avoider. I was hoping that person would never walk down the hall and walk through my door. I was hoping not to see them in the hall. And suddenly you're talking about buying a plane ticket, you know, loading up with a bunch of files and starting a conversation that you don't even want to ever have to have, but
right,
you're
going to
initiate that conversation.
Yes.
And that's when this whole imagery of walking up to the cage, opening it up, and inviting the 500-pound gorilla into the room, that's where that came from. And this
yes,
was a big, big learning for me. And I cannot tell you how many times when I have been tempted to avoid conflict, to hope it doesn't happen, to hope it goes away, to hope they don't discover it, I've thought to myself, no, I have to initiate this conversation. So you guys load up, go to New York, start the conversation, tell us what happened.
Yeah. Well, you know, and it's also about accountability too, because, you know, we had 12 to 15 years of audited financial statements from the very beginning of my company. So I had a credibility track record that I also needed to protect. And we had great financial information within our company. And as I told these bankers, I said, we're providing all this financial information for ourselves. You just happen to be a recipient of it because it's necessary for you to make financial lending decisions.
Right.
But we're using it daily to manage this company and the tremendous growth that we're having. So we called these people up and we said, we want to come to New York and tell you about a situation that's going to come up next June and what our game plan is to handle that. Well, that was totally odd for them to hear that kind of conversation.
Because usually they're having to track you down.
Yeah. I mean, when a borrower gets into trouble, the last thing he's going to do is call his banker and say, hey, I got a problem over here.
Yeah.
I'm not going to be able to make my payments. And usually, if he does, he's doing it the day before the payment's due.
Right.
So we made the decision that we want to be way out ahead of the headlights. We want to look down the road and around the corner, and we wanted to keep the car keys to our business. So we figured, with Tom Mayfield's guidance and prescient decision-making abilities in this arena where he was an absolute expert, that we needed to go initiate that. So, and a lot of people, Andy, like you talk about in your situation when we talked about it, all of us have the nature. I mean, it's not an abnormal thing not to want to go confront a situation. It's normal not to want to do that. But when you initiate that and you go do that, then you take a lot of pressure off yourself and you take a lot of pressure off the person that you're doing that with, because generally you're relieving them,
right,
whether it's they were not able to do the job or it was the way they were handling their own personnel in an environment that you had to go communicate with them about. You take a lot of pressure off of them by opening that cage and talking about that subject. So we got to New York. By the time we got there, we're talking to the third or fourth relationship manager. And when they knew we were coming, they were thinking, well, maybe we need to get another expert in here to tell us, should we even continue doing business with the people that we've just lent $12 million to? And so there was a guy in the room named John Bamback, and he was a very stern, I call him the black hat guys. He was very stern looking, and we walked in, and we started with our presentation because we called the meeting, and they started interrupting us, asking us questions before we got to the answer. And so I stopped them, and I said, you have to let me make my presentation because this is my meeting. I called this meeting. When I get finished with my presentation, please ask us any question that you want to ask us. So I made my presentation, and this real stern-looking guy, John Bamback, who ended up being a wonderful person in our life, said to me, Mr. Renfro, he said, tell me why you think that I should recommend to this bank that they work with your company. And I just immediately said, well, Mr. Bamback, that is a great question, and I'm so glad you answered it, because there's two very distinct reasons that you should make that recommendation. Number one is evidence you can trust us, because we called the meeting 8 months ahead of time.
Yeah, you didn't have to come looking for us.
You didn't have to come looking for us. These people here, this young lady here who's now the third relationship officer, has never, ever had to ask us for financial information. Matter of fact, she's calling us saying, what does this mean that you sent me? What does this mean? How can I use it? What does this mean? So number one, you can trust us. And because, Andy, that it was a non-recourse loan, and I knew it, he knew that I knew it, and Tom Mayfield knew that he knew that we knew it. So we said, Mr. Bamback, the second reason that you should recommend working with our wonderful company is, and then I took the car keys out of my pocket.
Your car keys.
My car keys. And I threw them on the desk, and I said, unless you guys think you can run a billboard company in Middle Georgia, you should work with us. And the room went stone dead. I mean, you could have heard a pin drop down on Madison
Nobody
Avenue.
There had ever been to Middle Georgia.
Nobody. No, really. They literally had never been to Middle Georgia up until that time. And so he just looked at me, and I'm thinking, boy, I boogered up, because he's about to cut my throat and tell him, get the keys, you know. And he looked at me for about a minute, and he just grinned, and he looked over at this young lady that was my relationship officer and said, I think we ought to work with these people.
So at the end of the day, they didn't take the car keys. You know, they let you keep your company, and you got through this difficult time. And then the company you mentioned earlier, Iron Mountain, came in and bought data management.
Yeah, yeah. Well, the good news, and thank you for reminding me again of that, is that they did continue to work with us, and because we continued to perform and give them the information and do the things that we told them that we would do, and we kept going back up there, as you
recall.
I remember
you told them you are never going to have to come look for us.
No, and as a matter of fact, they, after our third trip, they said, we're guilty. We feel so guilty. We want to come to Atlanta on the next trip and see your facility and do that. So that really worked well. And because they did that, because they allowed us to continue on, because they trusted us, and they trusted us, as I said earlier, because we exemplified that. We showed them that they could trust us. And so that made a big difference to that lending institution. So because they did that and continued to work with us and let us expand that business continuously, we really made it into a really big, significant business in Atlanta, Georgia. Then the Olympics came, and that just accelerated everything in Atlanta, Georgia. And we owned this building downtown, the Hastings Seed Building, which is next door to the Aquatic Center. And we had somebody wanted to buy that and put loft apartments in it, so they paid us a fortune for that, because they wanted to have it built before the Olympics came. And then right in the middle of that, we moved all the records over to Charlie Brown Airport in a what I call an aircraft carrier. It was a 200,000-square-foot building, and we started moving all the records there, and that's when Iron Mountain came. The Olympics, all the economy was coming back. Everything was rocking and rolling, and they needed to be in Atlanta because they were a huge national company.
So they bought the company.
They bought that
management. Got you completely out of debt.
Totally out of debt.
Put some money in your pocket.
Money in everybody's pocket. And we built more billboards and built more mini warehouses, and that was a great, great ending to that. And I think is one of the things I got out of that whole thing, as I share with my children, is that it's very important. Showing up is 98% of anything. I tell them that all the time. And we showed up at that bank. We had a game plan, and we were willing to work hard. So if showing up, having a game plan, and hard work wins, then we're going to win.
Well, as I mentioned at the beginning, our relationship and this conversation actually began over breakfast and then became a series of breakfasts. And so I lived with you and walked with you through this journey.
Yes.
But I'll never forget the morning when I finally confided and said, you know, Charlie, in a much smaller way, I have a situation at work and I'm avoiding conflict, and I told you about the situation. Again, it was embarrassingly small compared to what you had been through.
But the principle was the same.
The principle was the same, and you looked at me and you kind of brought that hand up, and the way you would do, and you would point it at me, and you said, Andy, I'll tell you what, when we finish breakfast, I want you to go out there, get in your car, you drive down there, you walk down the hall, you throw open the door, and you invite the 500-pound gorilla out, and you initiate that conversation, and don't you avoid that anymore. And I'm telling you, I can almost feel what I felt that day, and it was life-changing, yeah. Because I realized several things, and sort of to wrap up this episode of our podcast, you have to initiate conversations. If somebody is looking for you, go looking for them. Right. If you think somebody's looking for you, if you think somebody, as you said earlier, if you think somebody is processing, how do I confront Andy or how do I confront Charlie? They shouldn't have to figure that out. Right. We should be standing at the door.
Right. That's true leadership.
Well, and as you said, it takes pressure off of everybody.
Yeah.
And to some extent, it throws the person that you're going to negotiate with off balance. I mean, yep. The bankers, after a while, it's like, really, you don't need to come here anymore. We got it. We got it.
That's right.
Leave us alone. We know that you're not going to hide from us. And the other thing that this illustrates is the importance of communicating early and often, early and often. I think usually when there's pressure and there's an emotional situation, we communicate late and very infrequently, because
right.
Again, we want to avoid. So again, I think part of the takeaway is when I find myself withdrawing, I need to remember early, often, early, often. And then the other thing that you illustrated so well with this story is your track record matter. The reason you are able to look at them and say with all sincerity, you can trust us, it wasn't a promise. It was a statement that was a punctuation
Facts.
On a series of events where you had been trustworthy.
Right.
So again, trust is the currency of relationship, and trust is the currency of business.
Yes.
And so when we need it, if we don't have it when we need it, then we can't play that card. But you guys had a history of trust with the bank,
yep.
And so when you needed it, you were able to pull it out, and they couldn't point to anything to say, we don't trust you.
No, and you know, the very end of that story, tragically, was that we performed mightily, paid them all off and all that. Several years later, because that bank did not have the right principles, they folded.
The bank?
The bank folded. They went out of business.
Wow.
Because they either had the wrong people in the right slot, or they didn't have the right counsel. They didn't have the right communication with their borrowers, and they made bad loans and bad decisions because they didn't have trustworthy people mm-hmm. inside the organization, and they folded. And
wow.
We're still here.
You're still standing.
We're still standing.
Well, that's it for this episode of the podcast. Make sure you join us next month. This wraps up our conversation with my good friend and mentor, Charlie Renfro.
Thanks, Andy.